We have Russell.
All right.
Oh, yeah, thank you. Good evening, my name is Russell Spatz, I'm an alcoholic. I'm a member of the Carl Gables Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's a privilege to be here, and we're continuing our series. I believe we're on step five, but who knows, you know? At these prices, you really can't expect too much, you know? We'll probably talk a little bit about step five. I'm trying, you know, what I haven't found necessary to have a drink since January 25th, 1981, and been around for a while, and after you've been around for a while doing this stuff, you know, one of the things that it does, I think, is it helps you connect a few dots. You know, you figure out a couple of things, you know. I used to know everything, and I was drunk all the time, miserable. Now I don't know much, and but I know a couple of things, and it's all wonderful. It's all good stuff. So I had to unlearn a lot of stuff. I think I spent the first 20 years unlearning crap. Unlearning crap that was keeping me sick. Old ideas. You know, it says, unless and until an alcoholic accepts his alcoholism and all its consequences, his sobriety will be precarious. And of true happiness, he'll find none at all. And if there's anything alcoholics should be interested in, it's happiness. And so one of the things that you got to figure out is the consequences of alcoholism. There's consequences to alcoholism. There's symptoms of alcoholism, and there's consequences to alcoholism. And one of the things I had to learn is what alcoholism really looks like. You know, for many years I thought alcoholism looked like drinking, because alcoholics tend to drink, because they say that's the symptom of our disease, the drinking. I tend to drink because I have this problem called alcoholism, which is with me all the time when I'm sober. And what the big book tells me, which is true, it's hard to see. When your life turns into a bottle, you don't really see this, because all you see is you can't stop drinking, you're getting DUIs and all that stuff. All you see is the drinking problems. But after you get sober, and you've been sober for a few months or a few years, then you start realizing, now I know why I drank. Or as one of my first sponsors said to me, I don't know whether I'm an alcoholic, I just think I'm crazy. And I said, you could be both. And that's the deal. Alcoholics drink because they're restless, irritable, and discontented unless they can again experience sense of ease and comfort, which comes at once by taking a few drinks. And that's why I'm an alcoholic, because no woman, no suit of clothes, no car, no amount of money, no prestigious job, no different state or different city, no house, no nothing material ever worked quite as well as just a few drinks. It was the best thing that worked. Now, I'll tell you something else I learned after I stopped drinking. All that other shit, it works too. You know, you can be addicted to all that other stuff. You cause all sorts of problems chasing all that other stuff. And, you know, this big book talks all about that deal. The 12 and 12 talks all about that deal. And one of the things I learned after 33 years of working on this program is after you get rid of the booze, you start chasing that other stuff, you start thinking of that other stuff, you go to discussion meetings talking about that other stuff. To try to take care of that thing we were talking about, you know, that thing. And that thing, you know, we all know about that thing. You see, you know, if you try to tell them out there about the thing you got, they ain't gonna understand it. You know, I understand, but you understand what I'm talking about, that thing. You know, you recognize me, people have that thing. Every once in a while, they come to the realization that nobody's gonna ever understand them. You ever tell yourself that? You know, what's the point? Nobody's ever gonna understand me. Nobody could possibly understand what I'm going through. You know, that thing where, you know, this is all good, but seriously, you're out by Venus somewhere, you're floating in the galaxy, and nobody could ever understand you. That's part of the thing. That emptiness, that void, that deal. And the problem with recovery, the problem with this program we have, this deal we're talking about, is not that it's complicated. It's not complicated. It's very simple. The problem if you're an alcoholic is it's impossible. You understand? It's impossible. It's just impossible. You can't do it. No alcoholic can. You can't do this thing if you're an alcoholic. It's impossible. Because it requires you to do stuff that is completely opposite to every piece of DNA in your body. And somehow, for some reason, I want to talk about that. I know it's on the fifth step, and you know, it's funny how all these things sort of merge together and you start connecting things. And so I want to talk about humility, not that I know anything about it. And I want to talk about humiliation, which I know a lot about. I want to talk about surrender. I want to talk about desire. Because, you know, one of the problems, one of the chief characteristics of alcoholics is, and we talked about this, is that it says, now this isn't me calling you guys names, it says in 12 and 12, it says the chief characteristic is defiance. I know what defiance feels like. I've sat in the back of the room, you know, while some guy is talking, and I had 3 months or 6 months or 2 years, and I looked at the guy and said, who is this asshole? Who does he think he is? They should be listening to me. You know what I mean? This guy doesn't know shit, you know? Who does he think he is? I know what that is. You know, I didn't know what it was before. I know what it is now. You know, before, you know, when I first came in, I just thought, well, that's just my personality. Because I'm a flipping genius. And he's an asshole. You know what I mean? And that's just my personality. Now I know that that's a symptom of defiance. When you're defiant, you just put down everybody in your mind. You think everybody's a jerk. You start off as a cynic. You're not even a skeptic, you're just a cynic. It's all bullshit, everybody's bullshit, it's too good to be true. You never hear an alcoholic saying it's too bad to be true. Oh, it's bad, it must be true. You know, that's the way we are. That's part and parcel of the consequences of being an alcoholic. The consequences of being an alcoholic is anything that's good, anything that's decent, everything that's healthy, every bone in your body wants to say it's a bunch of bullshit. So how do you get that new freedom and that new happiness and be rocketed in the fourth dimension of existence and experience much of heaven and get all that stuff the book promises you're going to get when in order to get it, every bone in your body says the things you have to do are a bunch of bullshit? How are you going to do that with an alcoholic? I don't know how many people here have ever sponsored people or gone out and actually, I mean, I think we're kind of neat. I kind of like alcoholics, but you know, if you really want to get a taste for alcoholics, you got to sponsor a bunch of people. You got to sponsor some people that aren't ready, and you'll get an idea of what we're really like. And what you got to wade through, you know what I mean? When you try to convince an alcoholic against his will what they ought to do, you know? You got to stand. We're pretty stubborn guys, you know? So I want to talk about a few things. I want to tell you a couple things. You'll sort of put this thing together. I was born in Great Neck, New York. I lived in New York for no particular reason why I'm an alcoholic, because I lived in New York. But when I was about 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 years, you know, that kind of thing, that age, young boy living up there, and we had a bunch of guys in the neighborhood. We'd get together and we'd play ball and stuff like that. And it seems to me, I may be wrong, that when I was a kid growing up until the age of like 18 or something like that, what guys were, I don't know anything about girls, but what guys were, you know, really interested in was sports. I mean, I'll tell you, if you were good at sports, you know, then, at least my perception was, you know, my perception is not necessarily correct, not necessarily right, you know what I mean? But my perception was, the guys who were good at sports had it made, the captains of the football team and everything like that. My problem was this, I happen to know we have some captains of the football team that are here tonight. You know what I mean? So that's not necessarily true. But you see, I want to tell you something. I was always bad at sports. Any type, you name the sport, I was bad at it. There isn't a sport I'm good at, you know? And the bottom line is, in order to be popular, that's what I thought with the guys, that's what, you know, the deal was all about. And has anybody ever felt humiliation? That you can remember? You ever felt humiliated? How's that feel? You like that deal? You know, if you're here, you've been humiliated. Nobody gets to A without a little bit of humiliation. Hey, I got some good news for you. Some got great news for you. There's a lot more coming down the pipe. You ain't even seen it yet. You're in for a really joy. This is going to be a good ride for you guys, you know? You think it's all fun and games, you know, laughs and giggles. You're going to see what the deal is. You know what the 12 and 12 says? It says the way we get a new perspective is through 100 forms of humiliation. This is not basic text. This is the big, this is the pro. You guys are here because you want to know about the program, right? You think this is the program is like, don't drink, go to meetings, and everything's going to be wonderful. Except, you think the program is like, acceptance is the answer to all our problems, you know? That could be written on a matchbook cover. You think that's the program, right? They got this big book here, you know, they got this 12 and 12. You think that's, listen what it says. It says in step, it says, the way we get a new perspective, I'm an alcoholic. I used to think that I didn't have a drinking problem. Anybody here ever used to think they didn't have a drinking problem? Okay, great, okay. Anybody here used to think not only they didn't have a drinking problem, that drinking was really the solution to the freaking problem? Okay, okay, great, okay, so, okay. Anybody ever have anybody come up to them before they admitted they were an alcoholic and try to talk to them about their drinking problem? How'd you feel about that guy, you know what I mean? Okay, so listen, it would be safe to say if you're here right now, you've had a change in your perspective. Would that be correct? You've had a change in your perspective. You used to think that you could drink, you didn't have a problem, you could stop whenever you wanted, and even if you couldn't, it didn't matter, you weren't hurting anybody, everything was okay. And now, for most of you guys, you know, drinking is the last thing you want to do. You realize you're an alcoholic, you admit you're an alcoholic, so you've had a drastic change in your perspective. And although I can tell that you guys are highly intelligent, I'll bet the change in your perspective had nothing to do with your intelligence. It probably had something to do with something called humiliation. You probably were humiliated. You probably had some bad shit happen to you. The wrong time, bad breaks and misunderstandings and bad shit. And at the end of the bad shit, at the end of the humiliation, came a gift. You got a gift. You got like an incredible, you know that there are people out there dying, committing suicide, in jail, arrested, and they don't have the gift you guys have. And you want to know something? Most of them will never experience what you're experiencing right now. It says, we are over 100 men and women who have recovered from a hopeless state of mind and body. A hopeless state of mind and body is when you're an alcoholic and you can't stop drinking. I ain't talking about my girlfriend left me, my boyfriend left me, I don't have any money, you know, what am I going to do? My life is screwed up. I'm talking about you wake up in the morning, you say, with all the seriousness you can muster, I ain't going to have a drink today, and by 5 o'clock you're drunk. And you do that over and over and over again until you're 31 years old, and you throw up your hands and say, I can't never stop drinking, my life is over. Your life is over at 31. Your life is over at 31. You can't envision going on and keep on drinking, you can't envision stopping drinking. You know what that is? That's a hopeless state of mind and body. And everybody in here, if you're an alcoholic like I was, if you suffer from the same disease I was, I mean, I wasn't just a heavy drinker. I was an alcoholic. I drank against my will. I drank when I didn't want to drink. I'd announce that I'm not going to drink. You know, I'd go on the wagon and I'd drink. It didn't matter. If you're an alcoholic and you're in here, you got to a point where you couldn't stop. You ready for this? Powerless over alcohol. I looked the guy in the eye. You know what I said to him? 33 years ago, a little over 33 years ago, I said, I need help, I can't stop drinking. I didn't say I needed a girlfriend, I didn't say I needed money, I said I need help, I can't stop drinking. I mean, who the hell says that? I go to the Kiwanis Club, I go out there, I stop a guy on the street, I say, you know, I need help, I can't stop drinking. They're looking at me and say, what are you talking about? I come in here, you know exactly what I'm talking about. We are over 100 men and women who have recovered from a hopeless state of mind and body. Everybody in here has already recovered from that deal. You've already given that gift. And 90% of the alcoholics in this world, or maybe 95% of the alcoholics in this world, will never have what you have in your pocket right now. Will never get it. And some of you guys, with the gift you have, are going to give it up and throw it away, and you're going to go out and drink again. As a matter of fact, truth is, statistically, most of you guys will. I mean, that's just the statistics on it. 0.5% stay sober for more than 20 years. It's 1 in 200. Stay sober for more than 20 years. So you got that gift. So how does that happen? What's that deal all about? So I'm in this. I'm a kid in Great Neck, and we go down to the baseball field, and there's about 18 kids, and we're choosing up sides. And there's because apparently this alcoholism. You know, now I realize, you see, I've been sober for 33 years. But you understand? Well, you ready for this? I've been physically sober from alcohol for 33 years. So I know what it feels like to to experience this disease sober. Physically sober. I know what the disease feels like sober. You know, I get that, okay? As a matter of fact, you know, I sort of remember the way I was experiencing this disease when I was drinking, but I mostly know what I'm really good at is telling you what the disease looks like when you're sober. I sponsor guys that call me up and they have problems, they have emotions, they have all sorts of difficulties, they're going nuts, and they come up and they talk to me about it, and I see firsthand the disease in a guy that's sober 10 years. I know what the disease looks like with a guy who's sober 20, a guy 20 years sober. I sponsor a guy 25 years sober. He calls me up on the phone, he's talking to me. I listen to him, and I'm listening to the disease talk to me with a guy who's 25 years sober. So, since I know what the disease looks like when we're sober, physically sober, you know, disease is really, it's really clear to me about this deal. You can understand when I say to you, I had this disease when I was 8 years old. You know, now I didn't know it was a disease. I thought it was just, you know, you don't know it's a disease. You know what? I just thought it was me. It's just me. I am the disease. The disease is like from the top to the bottom. It's all over. I'm 100% this disease. It's always with me. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if I go to California. I still got it. Doesn't matter. Hey, it doesn't matter. You know something? I could lose 50 pounds. I'd like to lose about 100 pounds. I don't know what I have to lose. I don't even know why. But I'm an alcoholic. I just want to do it, you know. But in half an hour, I'll watch one of those commercials. I'll pop a pill. Whatever it is, you know. Some vanity. I want to be better looking. I want to have blonde hair. I don't know. Whatever. I want a better car, whatever. I just want to do because, to me, it's not a disease. It's just the way I am, the way I think. It's just everything that motivates me and drives me. It's just me. It doesn't look like a disease. It looks like me. The problem is me is killing me. But I don't think of it as a disease. Most of the guys I hang around, they think and act like I do. So how can I be diseased? I mean, they're not diseased, so how can I be diseased? Every once in a while, I'll meet somebody by accident that doesn't think like me or act like me, and I just think they're stupid. I call them the happy church people, you know what I mean? Well-adjusted bullshit artists, you know? I like you guys better, you know what I mean? I got this disease. Now, I'll tell you what it looks like. You know what the disease looks like when you're 8 or 9 or 10 years old? Let me tell you what the disease looks like. So I'm down there at the baseball field, that football field, and we're choosing up sides. And you got two captains. Now, if anybody, you got Fred and Joe, you know? And what happens is you got about 16 guys, 12 guys in the middle of the field. And there, you ever go through this choosing up sides deal? And I'm in the middle of the group. And Joe says, well, I'll take Charlie. And Charlie leaves the group and goes over to Joe's side, okay? And Fred said, well, I'll take Steve. And Steve leaves the group and goes over to, you know, Fred's side. And they keep choosing guys up. And as they're choosing these guys up, if you've ever been in that deal, the group that's in the middle of the field is getting smaller. You know, and you know what they're going? Eventually there's going to be one guy left. We'll call him the asshole, okay? Mike, you're laughing. You don't know what it's like. I'm looking at you. You don't have a clue what this is like. You're one of those asshole captains. I know what they look like, okay? So they're choosing up sides, you know, and I'm in the middle of the group, and this is what I'm thinking. I'm saying, at 8 years old, I'm saying, please don't let me be last. Please, God, let me be last. I'm praying to be second to last. Listen to me. Now, this may sound strange unless you've ever been there. But to me, to be second to last was like winning the flipping Oscar. You know what I mean? It was like the Pulitzer Prize, like the Nobel Prize. Just don't let me be the guy they hated the most. The guy they didn't want, because you're an alcoholic, you're a rejectaholic. You're a please love me, don't reject me, don't look at me funny. Why are you doing that to me? I mean, that's why we have the fear of the people deal. That's why I used to say, well, I love people. He says, well, why'd you always have to be a drunk around them? Whenever you went to the wedding, because if you weren't worried about whether they're going to like you or not like you or anything, because you're so flipping worried about their judgment and how they're looking at it, you're thinking about you, because you're always thinking about yourself. You just need to whack down that stuff because you're worried about whether you're going to join the group, whether they're going to let you in the group. You whack down some of that stuff. You feel like you own the group. You feel like you are one of the captains. You feel like what the captain must feel like. Because I could drink that stuff, because you're a nothing. You already know you're a nothing. You know you're not good enough. I was always going to be a nothing. I used to put some crap into my body that turned me into an almost. When you're a nothing, almost is like top of the world. You know, so I'm sitting there in the middle of the group, praying, you know, to whatever, you know, back then it probably was a higher power. I didn't have a name for it. Today I have a name for it. I'm praying to I'm just saying, please don't let me be last. And it seems to me I was always chosen last. Yeah, that's what it seems to me. Maybe that's not true, but it seems to me. Maybe once in a while I get second to last. And you know the way they choose you? This is the way they do it. I don't know anybody's been involved in this. They're not, kids are not nice. They say things like this. You're the last one, and they go, oh, do we have to have them? It's like they would rather play with one less, you understand, than have you on the team. Now, let me tell you what that is. Now, the reason I like that story is it tells, because there's a lot of things you can learn from that story about alcoholism. Number one, I remember the feeling of humiliation. I know what humiliation feels like. That's humiliating. To have that happen in front of people, that's humiliating. And I remember exactly how I reacted. How I reacted, because the way I reacted is the way I've reacted my entire life. You know, and it's just, and it was automatic. And I didn't have to go to meetings to react this way. It was just the way I reacted. I'd be in the middle of the field. I'd be the only one. They're saying, well, do we have to have them? I feel like deep down inside this sense of feeling like a piece of shit, feeling like a piece of crap, wishing I was dead, wanting to run away and cry, wishing they would all die, wishing I could, like, you know, disintegrate them. I had this overwhelming feeling of horribleness around me, and while they're laughing at me, and my reaction, my automatic reaction was to somehow, some way, in the back of my mind, it occurred to me that if I cried or let them know how I felt, something terrible would happen. And the only way I could protect myself, and I'm not sure what I'm even protecting myself against, but the only way I could protect myself is to act like it didn't bother me. Now this thing is killing me, but somehow it said to me, make believe that it doesn't, that they're not hurting you. So what I start doing is I start laughing at me like they're laughing at me. Like I'm not, like it's a big joke, you know what I mean? I'm like acting like I think it's funny too. It's almost like I'm standing where they're standing laughing at me. So, you know, and that's sort of like, because the one thing I sort of like know is, don't let them know what's really going on inside of you. And somehow by doing that, there's some sort of wall, there's some sort of invisible shield that comes between me and you, so that this protects me and makes me feel safe and gets me through the experience. And how did I know that little thing that I built up between you and me so that you could never hurt me, by the time I was 18 years old, was going to be 4 feet thick, and nobody would ever know what the fuck I was feeling. And you want to know something? You know what the bad thing is? I had no idea what the hell I was feeling. I had no idea what was going on, because I was doing so much acting that I had lost the concept of whether I was acting, I didn't know what was going on. Did I really feel the way it became so automatic for me to act or feel or do and be in reaction to what was going on around me. I didn't even know, you know, I used to get in touch with my feelings. I had no idea what was going on. You know, it's a funny thing in the book on the fifth step, it says this. It says, let me see where I can find it. I just saw this just today. It says, more than most people, the alcoholic leads a double life. He is very much the actor. To the outer world, he presents his stage character. This is the one he likes his fellows to see. He wants to enjoy a certain reputation, but knows in his heart he doesn't deserve it. This is our basic text, boys. This is me. This is the deal. And so this is going, and somehow, now here's the deal. By the time I'm 18, 19, 20, 30 years old, I ain't telling you shit. And you want something, even if I tell you something, I don't even know whether I'm telling you the truth. Because I don't even know what the truth is.
Yeah.
All I know is I'm dying inside. I don't even know what the answer is. That's it. So you gotta understand, you're talking about, when you start talking about the fifth step, and by the way, I don't want to leave this out, just for the heck of it, I want to read something. It says this. It says, before the fifth step, after we do the fourth step, they say, perhaps there is a better way. We think so. For we are now on a different basis. The basis of trusting and relying upon God. You know, there's a lot of that stuff in there. Somehow, listen, I don't know the answer, but let me just tell you a little secret that I learned after 33 years. And you got to read this book, cover to cover, over and over again. Somehow, some way, where you got, if you're out on that football field, and you got that thing between you and everybody else, where you're empty, you got that thing we were talking about, where you're empty, you got that void, nothing is filling it. The women ain't filling it, the men ain't filling it, the sex isn't filling it, the car isn't filling it. Nothing you do fills it for more than 10 seconds, and you got to go on, you got to keep on going. You know, losing weight doesn't fill it, exercise, it's just a constant drive and battle to fill it and make it better. If you got that thing going for you and you don't know what it is and you want to get rid of that, you want that new freedom and you want that new happiness that they talk about. You want those remarkable things happening to you. You know, you want that deal. Somehow, some way, I'm just going to tell you, if you want to go from here to over there where that new freedom is, let me just tell you the bottom line. This is what the book says. You're going to have to surrender. You're going to have to surrender to God. I mean, I hate to tell you that, but that's the deal. You're going to have to do the surrender. And for most alcoholics, that's impossible. That's where the problem is. It's impossible. They want to do everything else other than that. They'll go through the steps as sort of like, as an exercise. But that deal they don't want to do. Perhaps there is a, you know, it says, see to it your relationship is right. They just don't want to surrender. They don't want to surrender. They don't even want to turn off their cell phone for an hour. I'm sorry, you're in this group. I'm going to tell you something. You're in this group and you're an alcoholic. As far as I'm concerned, you're going to be Exhibit A. When you start acting out, you're not going to be immune to that. You understand what I'm saying? You're not going to make yourself immune. Believe me, I'm not a codependent. I'm going to point it out because it's a good example for us. That's the difference between surrendering and not surrendering. Let me tell you something. That's how horrible this disease is, because you can't help it. You can't even help it. You can't stop yourself from doing the stuff you do. Perhaps there is a better way, we think so, for now on a different basis, the basis of trusting and relying upon God. We trust infinite God rather than relying upon ourselves. We are in the world to play the role He assigns, just to the extent that we do as we think He would have us, and humbly rely on Him does He enable us to match calamity with serenity. Later on, before they get to the fifth step, they say this. Having made our personal inventory, what shall we do about it? We have been trying to get a new attitude and a new relationship with our Creator and to discover the obstacles in our path. That's what this whole thing is about. Trying to get a new attitude, a new relationship with our Creator. You know, the thing we read all the time says there is one who has all power. That one is God. May you find Him now. He's the one who has the power. It says we got to get rid, more than anything else, we got to get rid of this selfishness. We must or if it kills us. God makes that possible. When you sincerely try to do these things and turn your life over to Him, all sorts of remarkable things happen. Being all-powerful, He gives you everything you need if you stay close to Him and perform His work well. See to it your relationship with Him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. No man is going to do it for you. No woman's going to do it for you. You can't manage your own way out of this thing. Only God could and would if He were sought. Burn the idea into every alcoholic's mind that he can get well as long as he has a relationship with God. Job or no job, family or no family, it's all about a relationship with God. You can go through the book over and over and over again, and the one thing that is drummed into the mind of an alcoholic is you must have total and absolute surrender. Total and absolute surrender. You can do the fifth step, the fourth step, the third step, the 22nd step. You can go to every treatment center in the world unless there's total absolute surrender and you place yourself under the authority of something or someone else. You got nothing. And you'll never have any, you'll never have what they promise you in there. You may stay sober for 20 years, you may stay sober for 30 years. You'll never have the promises they promise you in there, ever. And the whole program is designed to try to get you to the point where you surrender. That's what the whole thing is about. It's all about surrender. And as a group, as a wonderful fellowship, and I love this fellowship, you know, as a wonderful fellowship, we are all united in trying to not do this thing. We're like Congress. This is no different than the Congress of the United States of America. 200, 300 guys, you know, and gals, you know, all with different mindsets, all operating under the same constitution, all with different ideas how to do it. Let me tell you something, ain't nothing gonna be accomplished. We ain't getting nothing done because this one doesn't want to do it this way, and this one doesn't want to do it that way, and this one wants to shave off this, and that one wants to, and you've got your program, and I got my program, and nobody wants to do it the way they did it between 1935 and 1939. You know why? Because that's like me, that would be like me on the football field crying. That would be like me on the football field crying and saying, you hurt my feelings, and running away. I'll never do that. I will never let them see how I feel. I will never let them see it. They're never going to see. You will never know what's really going on in me. I'll just sit here and feel lonely. I'll just sit here and think about how you don't understand. Nobody will ever understand. You know, I'll just sit here and feel sorry for myself because you ain't never going to find, I ain't going to tell you crap. You know, and you know what that is? That's, by the way, that's alcoholism. That's what you got. That's the disease you got. It's not the drinking. Now, eventually you will drink. You'll drink or you'll use sex or you'll use something else, but that's what that deal is all about. That's alcoholism. So I'm driving to my house one day, and you know, when I was 15 years sober, I started going to a Bible study, and you know, and one day I'll get into that. But I started going to the Bible study, and I have all over my car. I've got like big books and Bibles and stuff, and I got this one Bible. It's like red and it's huge. It's a King James, and it's up there on the dashboard. And you know, I get the bagels for the Thursday morning men's Bible study or whatever it is. Every Thursday morning, I've been doing it for like 15 years, you know, at 7:30 we meet. So I drive up to my dry cleaners, and I drive up to this deal, and on my dashboard, I have the Bible sitting there, and this kid comes out, and he's like 17 years old, 18, you know, and he's got his pants, you know, I was about 18 years sober, something like that, and he's got his pants, I can't explain this, the waist, you know, where I have my waist here, you know, it's down here. Have you ever seen that? I don't even know whether that's a style anymore. Maybe that was a style. His pants are like down above his knees. And I don't even know what's holding him up. I have no idea what's holding him up. And he's talking to me, and he goes like this. He says, I got one of those. You know, he's pointing, but I don't know what that is, but he's got his fingers like forks, you know. I got one of those, and I'm trying to figure out what he's pointing to. He says, one of those. He says, yeah, one of those. And he says, one of those. And he's pointing to the Bible. I said, oh, you mean a Bible? He says, yeah, I got one of those. So I say to him, you know what it says in the big book? It says, you know, when you give your life, when you forfeit your life over, when you turn your life over to his will, you know, when you turn your will and your life over to his care, when you sincerely make that decision, you know, it's a tough decision. It's an incredible decision because it's a decision. See, here's the deal with humiliation. Humiliation will either kill you and drive you out there, or trials and humiliation will propel you into the next dimension. Do you understand what I'm saying? humiliation, worldly sorrow and humiliation will either kill you and lead to your death, either spiritually, emotionally, physically, or if linked with faith in God, it will propel you into that dimension, into that experiencing much of heaven. And every one of you are going to go through the trials, the tribulations, the bullshit, and where you end up at the end of that, this is the book of James, which this whole thing was based on, where you end up on the end of that is not going to depend on how smart you are, it's not going to depend on how good looking you are, it ain't going to depend upon your weight, it ain't going to depend upon your hair or your bust size or any of that stuff, it's going to depend upon your faith. Period, end of story. That's the only thing it's to depend upon. Because this world is way too rough for any of you guys and way too rough for me. A lot of moving parts. A lot of shit going on. A lot of stuff that's going to happen that you don't expect out of nowhere. It's going to come to you. And whether you're going to be a thumb-sucking crybaby or you're going to be, you know, one of the leaders they talk about in here, you know, the leaders are trusted servants. It says what happens is when you sincerely take this position, all sorts of remarkable things happen. And one of the things it says is you start losing concerns of your little plan's designs, you start having concerns for other people. It's just a natural thing. All of a sudden what happens is you stop thinking about yourself all the time and you just find yourself always thinking about other people. You'll wake up one day and you'll find, you know, when I first, my first 10 years, I went to meetings because I needed meetings. Now I still need meetings, don't kid me. I went to meetings because I needed meetings. One day I found myself going to meetings to see whether there was anybody there I could help. You know, that's I just wanted to go to meetings to see whether there's anybody there I could help. Now, how do you go from an individual who goes to meetings to get whatever you can get, to grab whatever you can get, to hear whatever you can get, to an individual who's trying to go to meetings to see if anybody there needs help? It's a change in perspective. So Leo, this young kid named Leo, he points at the deal and he says, I said, well, you got a Bible? He says, yeah. So I said, you ever read it? And he says, yeah, I read it. I says, well, he says, I really don't understand it. I said, well, you know, to understand it, it's good to study with other men and other people. And sort of get, otherwise, it might get boring. You may not understand it. There's a lot of words. It's good to study with other people. I said, look, you see my house? You can see my house from Pierre's dry cleaners. I said, see the roof over there? That house is, yeah. He says, tomorrow morning, I'm going to go to a men's Bible study. If you, at 7:30, if you're at my house at 7:30 tomorrow morning, I'll take you with me. He says, you will? I says, absolutely. And then I drive off. I forget all about it. The next morning, I walk out of my house at 7 o'clock, you know, in order to pick up the bagels, and who's standing by my car but Leo, this like 17-year-old kid, and he's got this Bible in his hand, and he's standing by my car. So I remember, you know, I said, yeah, I told the kid, you know, I said, oh, hey, how you doing? He says, fine. He says, hey, get in the car. So we get in the car, we go to get the bagels, we go to the, you know, Bible study. The guys at this Bible study, I was probably like 55 and I was like the youngest, you know what I mean? These guys are like, believe me, you know, they've been studying this stuff for like 40, 50 years, which is basically the same stuff we study. It comes from the same book, it's the same deal. And I brought this kid in like 17 years old, they thought they would have died and go to, it's like when we get a newcomer, you know what I mean? Like they died and went to heaven, you know? So he's there and he listened to the whole thing, he didn't really say anything. I think at the very end he said something like this. He said, you know, I think Jesus was an alien. And, you know, but these guys are just like us, you know, because they love people, you know? And he says, and you know what they said, keep coming back, kid. They told him to keep coming back, you know? Who knows? So we're driving away and he's saying, well, you think they like me? He says, oh, they love you, you're a great kid and all that sort of stuff. And then as we're driving, he says to me this. This is what he says. He says, do you think you could drop me off at my house? You know, instead of at your, I said, sure, I'd be happy to do it. He says, how do I get there? He says, well, you go back to where you picked me up at your house, and I'll tell you where you get there. So we drive back to my house, and he says, okay, go down that street to the stop sign and make a right. So we go down the stop sign and make a right. He says, okay, go down to that sign and make a left. So I go down and make a left. He says, go down, and he starts directing me here, there. Next thing I know, we're like 7 miles away. And he says, okay, that's my house. And while we're driving, I'm learning about him. I'm learning he's like a 17-year-old kid. He's got a single mother. He's got a little sister who's 3 years old from a different father. He has no father. He has no man. It's like, he's just like a kid, 17, just trying to figure out where the flip he belongs. You know what I mean? Just figure out who the hell he is and where he belongs, because he's got no man. He's got no father. He's got nothing in his life. He's just trying to figure out how to get along in this crazy world like we are. You know what I mean? And I'm talking to him and everything like that. And so I finally get to his house, and he says, there it is. And it's like 7 miles away from my house. 5, 6, 7 miles or something like that. So I say to him, I said, well, how'd you get there at, 7 o'clock in the morning? He says, I walked. He got up at 3:30 in the morning, took a shower at 3:30 in the morning, and he walked. He actually got my house at like 6 o'clock, an hour early, and he waited for me. You know? Now, how do you do that? How do you get that? Tell me how to get that with an alcoholic. Let me read you something, okay? In this doc, let me read you this deal right here. This is page 101. On the other hand, this is what they were doing in 1935, 36, 37, 38, 30. You know when you read that book where it says, rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path? Who has thoroughly followed our path? Who has done this thing painstakingly, thoroughly, utterly, our program of recovery? Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly, you do what we did, you'll get what we got. Let me read this to you. And listen, you don't have to agree with it. It's right out of the book, I'm reading it. But it might give you some insight. If you have a little bit of a problem, it might give you some insight. On the other hand, we were taking them upstairs and getting them down on their knees to surrender, which I felt was very important, a very important part. The surrender was more than important. It was a must. It was a must. Bobby, who came into AA in February of 1937, recalled that after 5 or 6 days in the hospital, when you had indicated that you were serious, they told you to get down on your knees by the bed and say a prayer to God, admitting that you were powerless over alcohol and your life was unmanageable. Furthermore, you had to state that you believed in a higher power who would return you to sanity. There goes steps 1 and 2 before you get to the first meeting. There you can see the beginning of the 12 steps. We call that the surrender. They demand it. They demanded it. They demanded it in front of people, down on your knees before you got to me. It says you couldn't go to a meeting until you did it. How many people did that before they came to this meeting? How many people has ever done that? If by accident you didn't make it in the hospital, you had to make it in the upstairs bedroom over the Williamson's house. Dorothy S.M. recalled the 1937 meetings when the men would all disappear upstairs and all of us women would be nervous and worried about what was going on. After about a half an hour or so, down would come the new man, shaking, white, serious, and grim. He had just been through an experience. And all the people who were already in AA would come down, trooping down after him. They were pretty reluctant to talk about what had happened, but after a while, they would tell us that they had a real surrender. A real surrender. I often wonder how many people that come in now would survive an experience like that, a regular old-fashioned prayer meeting. Not many. Now, you know what the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous has done with that? That's what they used to do. That was the surrender. You know what the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous has done with that? I'm not putting it down. That's just what it is. We've turned that into anybody want a white chip. We still have a little bit of a form of that. It's sort of like a little humiliating because, sort of, because you got to walk in front of people. But we feel kind of strange even about that. You know what I mean? We wouldn't want to hurt anybody's feelings. So sometimes if you go to the groups I go to, they say, anybody want a white chip? They say, well, if you're embarrassed, we'll put it over here and you can pick it up after the meeting. We make sure they really stay sick for a long period of time. Because we don't want to make anybody here feel bad or be humiliated or feel they have to surrender to anything or anybody. This is just a feel-good deal. The wisdom of the rooms. So next time you hear somebody say, rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path, just try to remember what the guys who wrote that book in 1939, what the heck they were talking about. What they were talking about. That's the kind of attitude and stuff these guys had to go through. True humiliation. It was humiliation. It was humiliating to get. It's humiliating to get down on your knees in front of men and women. It's humiliating to, ask somebody to sponsor you. It's humiliating to go up to somebody and do a fifth step and really, all this stuff requires humility and humiliation. It's a humiliating deal. But listen, all I can tell you is this isn't my idea. I didn't make up this program. You know, if I made up this program, we would be doing it just the way we're doing it now. Not hurt anybody's feelings, not force anybody to do anything, let anybody in who wants to come in, you know, not make anybody feel, you know, guilty about not, you know, we would do it like a feel good, like the way we do it. But I will tell you this, and this is wrong, right, or indifferent, and I'm not trying to change A, but I will tell you this. The truth of the matter is, the disease that we have has not changed in thousands of years. In other words, the thing that they were fighting in 1935, 36, and 37, the disease that they had is the same exact disease you have. The when they wrote that book and they say, we've been rocketed in the fourth dimension existence, we've been experienced much of heaven, you know, and when they start talking about we have a new freedom, a new happiness, and we lose fear of economic insecurity, when they wrote that because of this is what we did, the disease has not changed. What happened to them hasn't changed. Let me tell you something. Just because we decided to dilute the thing, just because we decided not to do it that way, doesn't mean it works. Doesn't mean you're going to get. Just because we've decided, because of our obstinacy, because of our defiance, because we don't like being humiliated, because we don't want to get on our knees, because we want to do it differently, just because we decided not to do it the way they did it, because they said this was a must, it was a must, this is the thing that worked, just because we decided not to do it doesn't mean that we're going to get what they got. Just because a bunch of alcoholics get together and get a committee and say, well, it'll piss this guy off, it'll piss that guy off, so we'll just change the whole deal and we'll do it differently so everybody will like it and nobody will walk out, you know what I mean? Doesn't mean, don't expect to get what they got. You'll get something. You know what they discovered in 19, they discovered in the 50s that people were staying sober. You'll stay sober for 10, 15, 20 years. There's a lot of people that are sober. They're hanging in there. I'm hanging in there. 14 years, I'm hanging, you know. Don't expect to get necessarily what they got with the real surrender. You know, the incredible thing to me is that, you know, somehow, some way, and for some reason, because we're all going to go through the trials, you know, some people end up doing that stuff anyway. They end up getting to that point where they do make that surrender. You ever hear people say this in an AA meeting? Well, if I heard that when I came to my first meeting, I would have left. You ever hear that? You ought to think about what that means. You gotta think about what that statement means. If I did that, if I heard that, I would have left. To go where? Left to go where? To drink. Maybe they would have left, maybe they wouldn't. If they left, they'd do what? They drink, right? And then they'd either what? Die, go to jail, or come back and get on their knees. Come back with a different attitude. So it's like a toss-up, you know, whether you do it their way, where they cut right to the chase, right? There was no problems with the first, second, or third step when you get into the meeting at their meetings. We only got a problem at our meetings, first, second, and third step. They had already knocked the third step down, but they had time to get to their meetings. No problem with that stuff. It's just a little something I'm pointing out to you that you might want to think about and you might want to read, you know. Next time you're trying to figure out, if you happen to have a number of years, you're trying to figure out how come you're not experiencing the deal they experienced. How come it's not working for you when you are, like I used to say to my sponsor, I'm doing everything. He says, you're doing everything. I'm doing everything and it's not working. When you start saying to yourself, but you're doing everything. So thank you very much. God bless you.